graduate student workers on campuses all over the country are fighting for their rights. And increasingly, on private campuses, they're doing it through unionization. Even the right to unionize is fairly new for these workers who are teaching in college classrooms and filling other essential roles in their academic departments. But they exist in this kind of gray area. Are they students getting experience or workers who need exactly the kind of protection and support unions provide? That question is playing out everywhere, including Missouri. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about the unionization of graduate students in the university workforce. I'd like to start with Meredith Kelling. She's working toward her PhD at Washington University in St. Louis. They're one of the largest private employers in Missouri. And Meredith, you are in the Grad Workers Union at WashU, right?
That's correct.
I understand that right now there's kind of a tent city on campus where grad workers are making some of their demands known to the administration.
There is. Martinville, which is named after our new chancellor, Andrew Martin, has been up and running for a couple of weeks now.
Is it in Andrew Martin's honor or?
I think we are just looking to get the attention of the chancellor.
Okay. Well, what are your demands?
Our demands are pretty simple. But pretty progressive for WashU. We're looking for $15 an hour for every campus worker. That it extends beyond graduate student workers to everyone working in housekeeping, food service, contracted labor. And then in addition, we are asking for subsidized childcare for all of those workers as well.
What do you do as a grad student worker, you personally?
It changes every semester. During a doctoral program, traditionally, the service that you provide for the university could be teaching one semester, research another, being a teaching assistant to a professor with a larger course. This semester, I'm doing research, and then next semester, I'll be working as a one-on-one writing tutor.
When you say doing research, can you describe what that means a little bit, like in terms of the things we often describe when we're talking about a worker's lot in life?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, it entirely depends on what discipline you're in and who you're working for. In the sciences, for example, it means a lot of lab work and research. Those are a ton of hours that grad workers are logging in the labs. And on my side in the humanities, it can mean doing a lot of writing, collecting materials for a professor. It can mean any number of things, but the bottom line is that it takes up a lot of time, and that time takes you away from, you know, you negotiate that time with the amount of time that you're spending on your studies. Are working. Yeah.
Can I just jump in and say, I would imagine you're also negotiating the amount of pay per hour with whether you need to get an additional job and et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, as a stipended student, grad student workers know they're sort of like baseline budget that they'll get for the year. And then you just sort of have to figure out every semester how many hours you're working and whether or not it's going to be required of you to take on some sort of additional work to get your bills paid.
So what's your personal story with respect to all of that?
Sure. So again, it's a 6-year program, so life can change a lot in 6 years. About a year ago, I had a baby, my daughter, and so that definitely added a whole set of new lines to our budget as a household. So at that point, I started taking on a significant amount of extra work in the form of freelance writing, which again takes, you know,
very lucrative second career as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot of demands on my time, and there's a lot of demands on our finances that aren't really, you know, accounted for in the plan of going to graduate school.
What are some of the other stories you hear from your fellow union members, fellow graduate students, about why they think this fight is worth fighting? Are there other experiences you've heard that really drive the issue home for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, for me personally, it's about graduate student parenting and the fact that graduate student workers haven't always been thought of as people with families, people with parental needs and other demands on their time and resources. There are other stories from people from international backgrounds. Our students who are here on visas actually are not legally allowed to pursue other forms of work. So they are entirely dependent upon the stipend from the university. Students with different abilities, different healthcare needs, mental healthcare needs, these things all cost money. And in the larger, longer fight to make grad school and all higher education accessible to everyone, we just need to make sure that our university understands that with all of these different backgrounds coming to the fore and all of these new voices at the table, we need to make sure that everyone is centered here and is able to be fully supported in their work.
I want to bring someone else in on this discussion. Vimal Patel has been writing about this stuff for the Chronicle of Higher Education for a while, watching it all play out on campuses all over the U.S. And Vimal, what's going on? Why is this all coming to a head right now?
Thank you for having me. That is a great question. So there's definitely more activity in terms of graduate student unionization drives. I think that can be traced back to the 2016 ruling that gave graduate students the right to unionize. But more fundamentally, there seems to be as Meredith was talking about earlier, she had a baby recently, and that added a lot of stress to the budget. The thing about PhD programs is they unfold typically when students are between around ages 25 to 35, and that's when all sorts of life changes are happening, and you're getting married, you're having children, and all of this while you're on a shoestring stipend and under a lot of stress. So I think there's more of a recognition that there's so much of what a university does that's powered by the work of graduate students, whether it's conducting research in laboratories or teaching undergraduates, that graduate students are supporting. So I think there's more of a recognition that graduate students are integral to the operations of the university.
Can you give some more of the political background on this for context?
Sure. So graduate students and graduate unions are at private institutions, I'm talking about, are in sort of a weird place right now. The right to unionize has been pretty blatantly political. The National Labor Relations Board, under a Bill Clinton era board, I think in 1998, first gave graduate students the right to unionize. A George W. Bush NLRB took the right away in 2004. Then the Barack Obama Labor Board in 2016 gave graduate students the right to unionize. So although grad students have a right to unionize, the unions, I think, smartly are trying to avoid putting any kind of case before the labor board for fear, rightfully so, that this Republican board would very likely, or very possibly, or even likely, overturn the right to unionize. So universities have
it's my understanding that part of the power of unionization comes from the idea that there is this larger body that keeps you from being just in a personal fight with your university or something. The idea that you could start down that path and then have your right to unionize taken away is really very scary, I would think.
Sure. And it's so in the public realm, in the public sector, it depends on state law. But it's been kind of a game of ping pong in the private sector. So the leverage that unions have is they realize that this could keep going back and forth, but they're appealing, or they're trying to appeal to universities as better angels. One thing I often hear that from unions is they're sort of tying universities to the Trump agenda, in that they are, they're able to sort of resist their graduate student unions because they have a little bit of leverage at the National Labor Relations Board now that it's majority Republican. But that's a great point, that this could go back and forth depending on who's the president.
What you mentioned, that this is what's happening at private institutions. What's happening at public universities? There are lots of graduate student workers in those settings too.
Yes, it's hard to say. I couldn't tell you whether there's more activity, more unionization activity before than there has been in the last decade or two. But the same issues, the concerns about stipends and really pay, there are many issues that graduate students rally around, but the one that kind of is central is pay. And if anything, students, generally speaking, their stipends tend to be a little lower at state institutions. So that's clearly remains a big issue at state institutions as well.
Talk to me about the relationship between graduate student workers and full-on academic staff, like professors, I guess. I mean, I've heard that it is a very delicate dance where there's kind of almost a familial relationship or mentoring relationship on one side, but also a sort of hard-to-ignore power balance where you really don't want to get on your faculty advisor's bad side because that could make or break your whole career.
Exactly, and that is a big rallying point around which unions rally around, because you're right, a faculty mentor can make or break their PhD student, and it's especially for international students. If you have a problem in your PhD program, it's not just a matter of you being kicked out of your PhD program. You probably have to go back home as well, because your visa is dependent on your being in a PhD program.
So that makes it
So,
hard to like say no to an unreasonable request.
exactly. Yes, definitely. And in fact, I'm noticing that some of these issues about the power balance are being addressed in some of these union contracts. For instance, the Brandeis University contract has a clause about that outlines how that relationship should look like, and if there's a concern that an advisor has about a PhD student's work, they have to meet with that student as soon as is practical and lay out a path forward about how to potentially improve.
I've heard that the, in some ways, diminished job prospects for these folks pursuing academic careers once they've got degrees might also have something to do with what's happening right now, just that there's less of a of an investment sense of it when you're the thought of I'm paying my dues right now, I'm suffering temporary indignities for this ultimate goal of being a professor with tenure, that likelihood has diminished. Is that part of what's happening right now?
That would definitely make sense. A $100,000 debt load, while you have a good tenure track job with long-term security, is much less daunting than a $100,000 debt load and being unemployed and having bleak prospects for the future. So I think that it would make sense that that is something in the backdrop that's animating many of these or many graduate students' desire to be in a union.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll get right back to this conversation on KCUR's Central Standard about the unionization of the graduate student workforce. Call in with your stories and perspectives at 816-235-2888. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm talking to Vimal Patel of the Chronicle of Higher Education and Meredith Kelling, who's in the Grad Workers Union at WashU in St. Louis. Hi again, Meredith.
Hi there.
And hi, Vimal.
Hey.
You know, Meredith, we were just hearing about sort of, I don't know, the path to an academic career and what's the reward at the end of it? And
yes.
With all that we've heard about the struggle along the way, can you tell me a little bit about why you want to do this?
So it's true that the job market is pretty dismal looking for people in PhD programs. If what you're pursuing is a traditional tenure track position, those positions are sort of shrinking across the board. Personally, I'm not looking to pursue a tenure track position. I'm looking to pursue other opportunities in higher ed to teach writing and to do some sort of like upward mobility educational projects.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that I'm looking to use writing classes and writing training as a means of helping students who might be first generation college attendees or Pell Grant recipients, people who have not traditionally found their way into institutions like WashU, and using writing training as a way of helping cushioning the sort of culture shock of moving to that place.
So this, your career is part of a larger vision of social justice, it sounds like to me.
It sounds like that, yes, now that I'm saying it.
And so it's you're pursuing a PhD because of mm-hmm. your vision for the world, not your vision for a career. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a native St. Louisan, and WashU is one of the biggest employers in the state, as you mentioned at the top of the segment, and one of the most powerful institutions in the region. And it seems like educating myself at WashU and working with people here is the best way to sort of realize the goals that I have for the community at large.
Vimal, we had here in Kansas City at UMKC what I think is an unusual scenario. It was in the news not long ago, and so I'm sure it's on mm-hmm. some of our listeners' minds. A professor actually resigned over allegations that his graduate student workforce was being deployed to clean his house and do mm-hmm. manual labor. And they really saw themselves almost as indentured servants trying to clear the stepping stones on their path. As unusual as I suspect that story is, what do you hear in it that might be relevant to this discussion?
Sure, it's a bizarre story. It's I think it's an extreme example of the precariousness that so many graduate students face. I think the more common version of that would be issues of who gets credit for a research breakthrough, or who gets first authorship on a paper, which in some disciplines there's a big difference between the credit you receive for being a first and second author, and if a advisor takes credit for something that should be grad students, the product of something a grad student did, there's really very little recourse that a graduate student has. So
when you say there's a big difference, a difference in terms of what? In terms of career stone? Between being a first author and a second author.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Just in terms of prestige and in terms of oftentimes who's cited by other publications that follow up on that research. So you tend to get more, and even when you are applying for, say, a tenure track job, oftentimes hiring committees, they put much more weight on the first author of a paper as opposed to the second, third, and fourth authors.
Do you think that an older generation, or maybe I guess even just a previous generation of academics, may be living with an idea of who is a graduate student and what their realities are that's based on the past? It seems like possibly the change in who pursues these careers that Meredith alluded to earlier and what their lives are really like could also be part of what's going on.
Sure. Yes, definitely. I think the generational aspect is definitely important here. And you often hear from academics of the previous generation, so academics in their 40s and 50s, that the job market was terrible when they were coming up, and they're right, it was bad. But if you look at all the data, it's just been compounding every single year. There are more and more people earning PhDs and fewer tenure track jobs. And each year, you're not just competing with the people who earned PhDs in your cohort, you're also competing with people who have earned PhDs in the previous few years as well. So you often hear people who say, suck it up. The job market's always been bad. They're right and they're wrong. It has been bad ever since ever since the late 1960s, but it's just been sort of on a downward slide ever since. So it's worse now for someone earning a PhD. The job market is more daunting than a generation ago.
I wonder if some people, though, also see academia as the kind of field that you're lucky to get to be in at all, which is, I would assume, a double-edged sword as far as getting people to take your struggles seriously.
Sure, there is that idea that you get to be paid for living the life of the mind. But for if you are an adjunct, you're basically oftentimes living at a minimum wage salary in many cases. So it's hard to see how that could be sustainable for the profession.
Meredith, jump in here.
Yeah, absolutely. I would add on the manner of adjunct labor, which, as we know, is a huge and increasing part of the workforce of academic labor. Those are not just people who are working at minimum wage. Those are people who are often teaching a 4-4 course load, which means they're teaching 4 classes each semester. They have more contact than many professors in many cases across the country, more contact with undergraduates. Than professors. They're doing an incredible amount of the heavy lifting of academic labor and not getting compensated for it. So that seems to be a particularly volatile situation. At WashU, our adjunct labor pool unionized a couple of years ago, and that's definitely part of the energy that we've been able to capture in our own movement.
Vimal, in one of your stories on this, you quoted a Columbia University grad worker who was talking about that, you know, he was in, I believe it was a windowless fourth floor office with a big trash bin catching a leak. And he was
forgot all about that story.
Yeah, he was frustrated by the sheen on the parts of the university that people could see, the image the university projected as compared with the reality that the people doing what Meredith has just described as the heavy lifting, in his case lab work, were living with.
Sure. There's definitely a frustration, especially at elite institutions, when students see endowments in the tens of billions of dollars and they don't see that trickling down to them. So stipends, they vary. There's big variances in stipends. At an elite institution, perhaps you're making around $30,000 to $35,000 per year, but at many state institutions in a humanities or liberal arts program, the stipend could be $13,000 or $14,000 a year, and it's hard to make a living off of that while doing everything that's required of you as a PhD student. So there's definitely a frustration of sort of that dichotomy of universities presenting this image to the world of prestige and elegance and grad students toiling away in windowless labs.
And I think you said also like buying their own air filters out of concerns for their health.
Sure, sure. I actually want to go back and read that story again. It's been a few years.
It was a pretty good article.
That was actually that was before or right after, I think, the NLRB gave students the right to unionize in a decision involving Columbia.
As someone who's been following this closely, are you seeing a difference in how the conversation unfolds on the coasts versus the Midwest? Academic culture seems like such a deeply ingrained part of East Coast culture to my casual observation anyway. It appears a little less that way here.
Sure, that's a great question. I would actually say I would split it between the East Coast and everybody else. I don't really hear much in the way of unionization activity even on the West Coast. So it really is centered. So much of the unionization activity is centered on the East Coast, and especially New York City. Like the 2000 or the 1998 ruling involving graduate students, I think that involved NYU. The 2004 ruling involved Brown. The 2016 involved Columbia. So there is a lot of unionization activity in the East Coast and not so much away from the East Coast.
Meredith, any final thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe the movement, the energy is sort of coming from that area, but it's also true that wider movements that are not just including grad workers, but are including everyone on campuses to pay a living wage of $15, University of Chicago, the University of Virginia, and Duke University have all recently promised to make that happen across the board at their campuses. So this energy is sort of evolving into something broader that includes all campus workers, and it's moving into different and perhaps unexpected areas of the country, for
Meredith
sure.
Meredith Kelling, thank you so much for joining us from WashU today, and good luck.
Thank you.
Vimal Patel with us from the Chronicle of Higher Education, thank you.
Thank you.
In just a minute, poetry where you might not expect it. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Eric Borden is a Kansas City construction worker and poet. He memorizes all of his poems and recites them instead of committing them to paper. He's put a video of a poem called Ditch Diggers up on YouTube. It's kind of a rallying cry for the dignity of not just construction workers, but all blue-collar workers. Well, the poem went viral. If you pull it up on your computer screen, you will see tons of comments from people who have worked behind a shovel, as one viewer put it. Eric's celebrity just keeps growing. He's recently been to Denver to recite Ditch Diggers at a big annual convention for the National Association of General Contractors. And that is just one of many similar invitations he's received. So, of course, we want to hear his story. I'm Gina Kaufman. Eric Borden, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thanks for having me.
How did you get into poetry?
I started when I was a kid, you know. I was about 5 or 6 years old, and I wanted a guitar for Christmas, and my grandmother got me a guitar. And I tried playing guitar, but I wasn't that good at it. But the sheet music, I loved reading the words. And one of the first songs I read was Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire. And that just kind of got me hooked. And then I started reading books by Shel Silverstein, you know, Where the Sidewalk Ends, you know, books that everybody read. And my dad always listened to Motown music. That's all he ever listened to was he loved Motown music. And I just listened to the words in them. And then some of his songs he'd listen to the 60s.
But song lyrics were your way in.
Yeah, and I'd listen to the words. That's why I don't really, I don't listen to one type of music. If someone has something to say, and I'll listen to anything.
The poem that we have heard about, that I was just talking about, that went viral, before we talk too much about, what inspires you, I wonder if you could just recite that poem so that people all know what it is that you do.
Yeah, it's just called Ditch Diggers. And it's, you say the world needs ditch diggers. That statement's true enough. But if you're saying it because you think you're better than us, then with you I've got a grudge. For we are every creed and color. We are woman and we are man. We fall into what society calls blue collar, and we are proud to wear that brand. Our hard hats are a resume, tattooed with stickers, timelines of who we are and where we've been, what we've built with our machines, our skills, our hands. For everyone is built to do something, and we were built to build this world. We're doing what we're designed to do, since we were just little boys and girls. Yeah, everyone's built to do something, and we were built to build this world. We're doing what we dreamt of doing, since we were just little boys and girls. And it goes on for a couple more minutes after that, but that's the beginning of it.
Yeah, but can you do the rest of it? I know that it's long, but I would love for people to hear it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll just pick up where I left off. So when you're heading down the road and you see those operators cutting grade on those big machines, and those iron workers cutting, welding, shaping, tying those skeletons of steel, those laborers, those carpenters getting ready for that big pour, take that bridge you're traveling across from 3 lanes to 4. And the crane operators, who will pick and pluck and place and set with precision and with ease, while their work and sometimes their office sways upon the breeze. The linemen in their bucket trucks, and the excavators out putting in the pipe. The plumbers who get the good stuff in and the bad stuff out, and the HVAC techs who give you the comfort in your office and in your house. From the high lines to the pipelines, we build, repair, service, the infrastructure that fuels your life. From the Golden Gate to the Brooklyn Bridge, we have built the monuments and the buildings that make up the silhouette of the skyline in the city in which you live. From the highways to the byways and the runways to the driveways, these things we build, well, they'll still stand long after we are gone. A testament to our passion. Do our part. Keep this country moving on. And some of us, well, we're born into it. It is synonymous with our family name. It is bred into us through generations, and it pulses through our veins. And others, well, we're those kids that played with Lincoln Logs and Tonka Trucks and all the like toys. And we grew to be men. We grew to be women who knew construction wasn't just for boys. Some earned their skill when for this country they did proudly serve. To them I say no higher respect could one truly earn. And the reason why we do what we do, well, it is simple to us, but it is too complex for passerbys to figure. So I ask them to ask themselves, how does it all get done? How does this world get bigger? And the irony is, the answer is, it rests on the shoulders of all of them ditch diggers.
There are so many messages packed into this poem, but it really does seem to be about dignity.
Yeah. And, you know, I've gotten a few messages. Most of the messages and most of the comments and the emails I've received have been pretty positive. And some of it, I've had just a handful that have been somewhat, lack of a better term, negative.
And those because can get under your skin.
Well, no. A good friend of mine always told me take the high road. So when someone has something like that, I just, you know, a lot of them will say, well, you need this or you need that. You need doctors, you need lawyers, you need physicians, you need engineers. And that's all true. And that's why in that poem it says everyone is built to do something. We were built to build this world. My own son is not built to do what I do. He's going to go off to college. But some of his friends aren't built how he is. And I just feel like one of the things that it's being used for that I'm pretty proud of, it's being used at graduations at trade schools. Next week I go and speak at the trade school I graduated from. And I go back every year and talk to the kids. And they always ask for me to come back. And I actually used that poem for the first time. First time it was ever done live was at that school last year before it was ever put out. And it gives the kids a sense of pride to let them know that where they're going, there is value. It is an admirable path in life. And once I talk to the people that send me the messages that maybe aren't quite so positive, and I reach out to them and explain to them what I was writing about and that, you know, I appreciate what they do for society. You know, if you're being cool to everybody and you're contributing to society and you're not hurting anyone,
and you're doing jobs that we all rely on.
Absolutely. Everyone is. But, you know, construction workers, blue-collar workers in general, no one really likes to look at a mechanic when he walks into the grocery store after a hard shift or after working third shift. But he did get that car running for you. He did, you know, or the HVAC tech or the plumber that made sure that your house still smells good because your pipes aren't backed up. The electrician, you know, when we have a big storm, you know, they're anticipating big storms tonight and high winds. And when you're inside and you're wondering about the electricity, there's men and women in bucket trucks out there braving the elements, and they aren't looking for anybody to pat them on the back. They weren't drafted. They signed up for it. And but what they do is dangerous. And people look at them and wonder why they do it, and it's because they have a passion for it. It's just bred into them, or they saw it, or something just impacted them along their lives, and it pays well.
You know, something that caught my attention in this poem, Ditch Diggers, hard hats are our resumes.
Oh, yeah. If you watch that one video, there's a pink hard hat in there, and that was my hard hat for a lot of years, and it got a crack in it, so I had to retire it. But it'd been everywhere. I'd been out the windmill farms. I worked for United Rentals for 9 years and ended up on a lot of jobs for them, everywhere from power plants to nuclear power plants. You know, I've been up and down this street a million times.
The street where the station is, on Troost.
Yeah, on Troost. When I ran in Kansas City with a boom truck setting stuff for people. And, you know, some job sites you had to go through training before you could be on there, and you put that sticker on there. And people know where you've been. It's your resume. People can look at it and say, you know, and sometimes people don't put the stickers on there, but I know a lot of guys that if you took off the stickers off their hard hat would probably weigh a half a pound less.
The another line that caught my attention is that, you know, we were the kids who played with Lincoln logs and Tonka trucks.
Yeah. My mom and dad were always buying me Legos and Lincoln logs and Erector sets, and I was always building something. And I got into remote control cars when I was a kid, and I can remember a teacher, you know, that's all I talked about for a long time. That's what I wanted. I just had a passion for it. And I can remember a teacher, it just drove him crazy that I messed with those. And he's like, nobody's ever going to pay you to play with a remote, Eric. And for 9 years, I ran a remote control boom truck. And I thought, man, I wish he could see me.
Yeah. The how does it all get done? How does it all get built?
How does it all get bigger?
How does it all get bigger? Yeah.
You know, people, it's like what's going on 435 right now. It's an inconvenience to everyone. But when it's done, it's going to be a huge convenience. And it's like the airport, you know. People see it on TV and they just know that it's being voted on, it's passed, and they're starting to tear down the old airport. But they don't see everything behind the scenes. They don't see everything from the people who deliver the Johnny on the spots or the portable bathrooms, to the guy that's out there in the early morning fueling and lubing everything, to the people that have to, the engineers, the safety people. It's a big dance.
Can you tell me more about, I mean, I feel like I'm picking up on bits and pieces from your childhood and where your passion comes from, and that it just seems to be something that's in you, like building, you're drawn to that. But can you take me through some of the milestones in your own passion and your own skill development?
Well, I just was never built for school. And it wasn't the teacher's fault. It wasn't the school's fault. It just wasn't how I was wired. And really, I had planned on dropping out of school when I was 16 and just getting a job. And that was about the time the first Gulf War was going on. And one of our teachers got called up. And the person that they brought in to take his place was a retired teacher by the name of Howard Smethers. And Mr. Smethers was a very good teacher, a very good mechanic, and had taught at the Johnson County Vo-Tech for years and was just a great human being. And him and I hit it off, and the school wasn't going to let me go to Vo-Tech, and he pulled some strings and got me to Vo-Tech, where I met a fellow by the name of Bob Miller, who became a mentor, and he was a great teacher. And he really gave me some direction. And so the first part of my working career, I was a mechanic. And then it slowly, some kids I'd went to school with, their dads owned construction companies or what have you, and I ended up going to work for them. And I just really liked the construction aspect of it, the men and women that I met and their stories. You know, I love a good story. And a lot of times, you know, at break, they'd tell us stories. And I worked with a lot of veterans that learned what they knew how to do during their service and just furthered that when they left. So I had a huge respect for them, and some of the best people I met that took the most pride in their job were military.
You know, a couple of things. One is, when I asked you to recite your poem, you just did it. I mean, people can't realize just listening that you were not reading from a
piece of
paper.
Yeah, I don't write them down.
And it's not a short poem.
No.
And it's pretty amazing to me when you talk about not being built for school. I feel like you just exhibited to me so many of the skills that make me think about people who are, like, good in school. And it seems like, I mean, a big part of this is just, like, what inspires you.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, and sometimes people will just say something that really sticks with me, or there'll be a poignant part of my life, and it sticks with me. How would I explain that? And, it, you know, I've had poems rattle, like right now I have three that I'm working on that are rattling around in my head, and I'll pick them up. That's why I say I just pick them up and I'll rattle, work with them for a little while and try to make them fall together. And
in your head you pick them up?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm always reciting lines, and I'm really excited for the next one to come out. I could be completely wrong, and I may have to eat my words, but I think it'll blow the ditch diggers out of the water.
I hope so. I can't wait to hear it. But I guess also, I mean, what also strikes me about what you're describing is that when you're on the job and you're meeting other people and listening to their stories, that kind of storytelling, I mean, it is not such a far cry from the reciting of poetry, mm-hmm. you know, like, but what you're doing is in some ways so old school. Like, you hear about people who were like traveling poets who just recited things in different communities. It sounds like that's kind of your role.
Yeah, but you know, You'd think I'm a rare breed, but I'm not. Actually, the National Cowboy Poetry Rodeo, it's going on its fifth year being held in Kansas, and it's out in Abilene the first week of August. And a fellow by the name of Jeff Dawson, who I met through poetry. And when you go out there, you realize there's nothing special about you. There's a lot of people out there. It's just, I don't fall into a genre like that. You know, most people, it's cowboy poetry, and they're writing about things that, yeah, I live in the country, but I'm not a cowboy. And so I don't write about the things that they write about. So I never really do well out there, but I've made a lot of friends out there. But I had a friend, and he's kind of the reason why I wore the pink camouflaged hard hat. His name was Trey Allen. One time we were sitting there, and he had over 2,000 poems in his head that he could recite. I mean, if you had the time, he could tell them to you. And he always wore pink shank boots, and all he'd ever done was run ranches. That's what he'd been his whole life, was a working cowboy. And I asked him one time, I said, Trey, I said, why you wear pink shank boots? And he said, well, because when I'm there, everybody knows I'm there. And so he was battling a real rare form of cancer, and he was staying in the Hope Lodge up here in Kansas City, and I'd come and see him and go get his groceries for him and stuff that he needed, because all of his family was in New Mexico, and they didn't really feel comfortable around Kansas City, so I'd go and do their shopping for him. And I needed a new hard hat, and I walked into a hard hat store, and the first one I saw was that pink hard hat, and I bought it, and I wore it for about 4 or 5 years in memory of him. And, I mean, he saw me, I sent him a picture of it and everything, and he liked the fact that I wore that hard hat. So every once in a while on job site, people give me a little flack about that hard hat. But once I told them the story, they thought it was all right.
You know, you mentioned that you always have some poems rattling around in your head that you're working on. I know you probably don't want to present like a work in progress, but is there another poem that you can share with us off the top of your head?
Yeah, this one, I did this the other night at the Heavies Banquet up at Arrowhead, and you always have people ask you, how do you come up with these poems, or, you know, how does it happen? And this is just called The Answer, and it's Johnny Cash and Chris LeDoux and Tom T. Hall and Dr. Seuss, and all of those who in my youth taught me the power of the words I use. From just 26 letters of the alphabet, I can paint pictures with words of love and life and loss, regret. Of daydreams in the Kansas Flint Hills that caused me to write, of daydreams still. It's my parents who had done their best to steer me clear of fool's gold quests. It's plagiarism, I confess, of the common man and their common sense. With their words of wisdom in times of silence that go into my head and shake around with a violence. And seem to fall out in some sort of way to form these little poetic phrases that pull on emotions and put smiles and tears upon the faces. It's all the what's, where's, and why's. It's all the who's and how's, and I could chalk it up, pure dumb luck, I'm even up here now. Putting all my memories into all these words, painting all these pictures of everything I've heard. And this answer that I've given you, well, it's longer than most desire, so I just simply look at them and say it comes from someplace higher.
The Fool's Gold Quest. Can you tell me about that?
Well, you know, my dad would always, you know, just the old adage, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. And my dad and mom, my mom grew up in a farming community, and my dad grew up blue-collar worker. His parents both worked for the railroad, and he worked for some farmers and stuff, but he worked for General Motors for 30 years. And he just, you know, a lot of those people that are cut that way, they just have a sixth sense to spot BS. And my dad just kind of tried to instill that in me, you know, and especially with the poetry, I've had some people, oh, if I'd have let them, they'd have taken advantage of it. But
in what way? Trying to commercialize it and profit from it?
Yeah, and I don't mind if they profit from it, but I got to figure out a way for me to do that first. You know what
right
I mean?
Right on, yeah.
I still haven't made a dime at it, really, but I'm working on it. The Tucson School District called me, and they're using it at their graduations out there. A lot of the trade schools were, and they called me and said, hey, can we use that at our graduation?
The poem.
The poem, yeah, and
that,
the video.
How does that feel?
It's neat. It's neat. When I don't read the comments very often, but my son will get on there, and we have an Instagram account, so I got to take some pictures here so I can send
them
to my
son. How old is your son?
He'll be 17 next month, and He's like, Dad, get pictures so we can put them on Instagram. And we've had a couple of podcasts call us, and I've interviewed with them. And what I like is it has – it's done three things as far as I can tell. And not that I was the one that needed to do it, not that the people out there weren't already this way, but for one thing, it's validated the blue-collar workers. And I get a lot of messages, people razzing me because I might not mention their trade. You just can't mention every
that
trade.
It would be a long list.
It would be. And I always tell them, hey, I apologize. Just know that it's as much about you as it is any other trade. So it's validated them and given them a sense of pride. A lot of the messages that I get are, thanks for putting into words what I've been trying to say or what I've felt for 40 years but haven't been able to get across to people. The other thing it's done, it's kind of enlightened people, made society look at us a little bit different. And it's neat when I get phone calls from, investment advisors. I get phone calls from companies that aren't tied to construction at all. But once they see the poem and they call and, one guy, he apologized. He said, I wasn't raised around the trades. I wasn't, lack of a better term, upper class or white collar job. And he said, watching that really enlightened me. And he's done some really neat things. He's stepped up and really done some really neat things for the trades and for scholarships, which he said, if he wouldn't have seen that video, he wouldn't have done that. And the third thing it's done for the kids that might be getting ready to graduate high school and are thinking about an apprenticeship somewhere or trade school somewhere, but are worried about what their friends might think or what society might think if they don't go to college, it's validated them. My wife had a kid. We made the original video back in 2018 with a group of friends of mine down in Drexel that had companies and helped sponsor it so I could come up with a way to pay to get it out there. And then that's when the AGC picked it up. And they turned around and my wife was at work, and she works at the little town, works at the school at our little town of Drexel. And a kid came in, and he was thinking about not going. He had got accepted into the apprenticeship for the electrical union. And he was kind of, his friends weren't real supportive, and he was thinking maybe he made a bad choice and he should maybe go off to college. And then he saw that video, and he came in, and he was kind of teared up and told my wife, I saw that video and realized what I was doing was okay.
Yeah, this is what I want to do. It feels like built into a lot of this is, it sounds like an assumption that people doing blue-collar work aren't doing what they want to do.
Right. Well, and
sometimes I'm sure is the case, but sometimes that's the case for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's people, there's lawyers that probably hate their job. There's doctors that probably hate their job. I mean, you read about it all the time on the internet, I was so successful. I was making six figures, but I wasn't happy. So I got rid of everything and moved away. And now I'm living on some island, I'm ad-libbing, but you get those stories
all the
time.
There's a comment under your video on YouTube where there's someone saying, I worked. That's where the behind the shovel line comes from. I worked behind a shovel for years. Now I'm sitting in an office in air conditioning, but I'm watching this video and part of me wants to just throw it all away and put the hard hat back on.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing, back to the video and that poem, one thing that I wanted to make sure when I started thinking about that poem, I wanted to make sure that it showed the diversity and it showed the inclusion in construction, because a lot of people, when they think about construction, they either think a white middle-aged guy in denim or they think a Mexican guy. They don't think about all, it says in there, we're every creed and color, and we're woman and we're man. One of the best bosses I ever had is a woman. I worked for her for 9 years, and I'd do anything for her, and she'd have done anything for me. She was a good boss. So when I started that, that's really something I wanted to get across to people. And I wanted to get that across, especially to the youth, that, if you're thinking about this, if you're thinking about getting into the blue-collar trades, and not just construction, any trade, know that it's not like you're not handicapped by what you are or who you are.
Well, Eric Borden, thank you so much for telling your story today, and I hope that we get to talk again soon. This is congratulations on attention your poetry is getting.
Hey, thanks for having me. You're actually the first radio station to call me, and I was excited, and I hope it goes well. I hope your listeners enjoy this.
Eric's got a website, ericbordenpasturepoet.com, if you want to check out more of his work. That's a wrap. You can hear either of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have them ready for you by the end of the day. And talk to us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and we've talked a lot about work today, what happens behind the scenes on the job. If you've got a story of your own, tell us at KCURCST. Tomorrow, music, documentary projects, all kinds of arty things on KCUR's Central Standard. This show is produced by Melody Rao, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.